My husband expected me to shoulder nearly all of the responsibilities of parenthood. I had severe mental health challenges in the perinatal period that would have been treatable with support. Instead, I barely slept for over a year due to infant care combined with intrusive thoughts. Everyone I reached out to for help said it was normal. I still carry most of the load. Meanwhile, he gets compliments when he does basic parenting tasks in public. Sometimes I feel like an accessory to his lifestyle rather than a human being with my own worth, dignity, and abilities. Hi, I'm Zonva Lines. I'm a writer and activist, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. I'm here today with my guest, Kate Anthony.
Hello.
Hi, Kate. I'm so glad to have you.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
So Kate is the host of the New York Times recommended podcast, the Divorce Survival Guide podcast, and a divorce coach who helps women, with children especially, decide if they should stay in or leave their marriages. And then she either helps them heal their relationships or exit with grace. Kate's new book, The D Word, is an amazing and comprehensive guide to assessing when and whether it's time to go and to getting out. You can learn more about Kate at her website, kateanthony.com. And I'm also going to put all of her information in the show notes because Kate has an abundance of resources available. And she's really just like a one-stop shop for women in troubled relationships. So that is why she's here today.
Yay. Thank you.
All right, Kate. So we're just going to get into it. We are seeing a huge wave of women getting divorced. And the frustrating response from men is, I have no idea why she left me. Everything was perfect. She divorced me because I left a dish in the sink. And she wouldn't fuck me. What a bitch. I see this constantly in my inbox from men who think it's just like unreasonable for women to have any standards at all. And it's clear to me that women are leaving because their partners don't listen to them. Like, imagine that. But you're the expert on this because you talk to women when they're contemplating leaving, when they do leave, and I guess in their very rare event where they decide not to leave. So why is this happening?
Such a good question. Well, so first of all, yeah, they're calling it the great divorce, like on TikTok and stuff, which I think is hilarious. Because first of all, it is great. It is so great that women are given the actually have the opportunity to choose whether they want to stay in dissatisfying or abusive marriages, right? And it is this radical concept that we actually get to choose. And men are so often blindsided. They are always blindsided. So the thing that I hear more than anything is, I've been telling him for years that I'm unhappy. I have laid out all of the things that we, you know, that need to happen in our relationship in order for it to not feel like I'm suffocating. And he didn't listen. And I begged him to go to therapy. And he said, if I have a problem, then I should go to therapy. Right. And the list goes on and on and on and on. And then when they finally go, okay, I'm done, they're like, what? I never saw this coming. It's just like, you never, actually what happened was you never thought I'd actually leave. That's actually what my ex-husband said to me when I left him, you know, 15 and a half years ago, about 2 weeks after I finally said, I'm actually done. He said, came to me and he said, Kate, I'm so sorry. I just never thought you'd leave. And I was like, oh, so you're sorry. You knew all along that the way that you were treating me, which was, you know, very emotionally abusive, that you knew that it was wrong all along and you could have stopped earlier, but you didn't think you actually had to. That's basically what that was, a confession. And whether they say it overtly or covertly, that's essentially what men are saying when they say they never saw it coming. And it's, you know, it's BS. They just never thought we'd leave. And this is part of the systemic issue that men really don't view us as full humans with choice, that deserve choice. And of course, we can see that now playing out on the broader stage with taking away, as you know, all of our rights, and with the growing rate of divorce, this great divorce, actually the divorce rate is falling, but that's because fewer people are getting married because millennials were like, yeah, this doesn't work for us. But, you know, now we've got it on the political stage and in all of the social fabric with the elimination of Roe v. Wade. And now in Project 2025, having the no-fault divorce being on the chopping block. So the sort of covert design of a woman shouldn't have choice is now actually becoming quite overt.
Yeah. So I have this theory. It's like the woman as appliance theory that most heterosexual men just see women as appliances. So like, of course your refrigerator is not supposed to tell you that you're mistreating it. Of course your refrigerator is not going to leave. And of course, if they threaten to leave, you just should replace it with a new appliance because they're all sort of interchangeable. And one of the things that I've talked about a lot, both on the podcast and in my personal life with my own husband, is how I think the thing that has made our relationship not rife with misogyny isn't actually the fact that he's a feminist or a progressive or like whatever label you want to slap on him. It's that he likes me and sees me as a person. And more and more what I'm seeing with the women I talk to is that it doesn't seem like their partners truly like them as people or ever liked them. So do heterosexual men actually like women?
It's such a great question. I used to say that to my husband all the time. Like, you don't like me. You just want, what I would say was, you just, it's like you want me to be a robot that you can program and then reprogram and then reprogram when you get bored with that setting and then reprogram, you know, much like a smart fridge, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's such a great question. I think they love what we provide them. They can't live without our labor. When they say they can't live without us, they don't mean that. What they mean is I can't live without everything you do for me. I think you're right. I think they don't like us very much. I mean, you talk about this in your work about how, you know, heterosexual men, they don't even like vaginas very much, right? Like, it doesn't make sense. And so, you know, they don't like our bodies. What they would like is for our bodies to look more like, I don't know, adolescent boys or something. And so, as you say, like, are they actually heterosexual? But no, I don't think they do. They don't like us. They certainly don't like us. Listen, they like us when we're trad wives. They like us when we cook and clean and support them and increase their profit margins by doing all the labor at home. Like, there are lots of things they like about us that have nothing to do with us as humans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really sad. Okay. So you and I know what the typical heterosexual marriage looks like because we talk to women all the time. But women don't really talk to other women about what their marriages are really like until things are really bad. I think that there's a lot of shame. Yeah. And, you know, the feedback that I get from readers and listeners all the time is, I thought it was just me. You know, I thought my husband was the only person using those scripts. So I think that there's really power in women understanding that there is like a standard issue patriarchal marriage and a standard issue set of male behavior you get with that marriage. So can you talk to me about what that marriage looks like? Like, what are most of everyone's friends experiencing in their homes?
Well, I think there are varying degrees, right? So there's a spectrum. As with most things. But primarily, I think there's a disparity, certainly, in household labor, childcare. You know, as you said, men are praised when they, you know, take their baby to the grocery store. But when women take their baby to the grocery store, not only is it, you know, normal, but also if the baby's crying, you know, there's shame or whatever, you know, this load of shame on us. So there's this disparity there's always the disparity in domestic labor. The other thing I think that we don't talk about enough is that we and this is something that I think women, we need to work on, is that we present our sort of caretaking and nurturing as our relationship currency. And then when we have babies, we shift our caretaking and nurturing to our babies and expect our partners to be partners. But we've been caretaking and nurturing them and somewhat treating them like our children, probably from the beginning. And maybe that's a little bit of an unfair sort of shift with no conversation or no, right? Like, we need to be more cognizant of what our relationship currency is in the beginnings of our relationships, so that when we actually have children, we are already in partnership with these people. You know, because what ends up happening is we're exhausted. Our bodies are a mess. We are caretaking these, you know, these little tiny humans that actually will die if we don't caretake them. And then we don't have the energy to like caretake the person who we want to actually be our equal partner in this. And then they get pissed off and resentful, and they resent us. And then they resent the children because they took away their source of nurturing and caretaking. But if we set relationships up, and by the way, this is not our fault. This is how we have been trained. This is the patriarchal structure of it all. But we need to, I think, expose it and examine it. That if we have a different relationship currency to start off with, the shift won't be as jarring or, you know, kind of tear at the foundation of the relationship. And again, I'm not saying that's women's fault. I'm not saying necessarily that's even men's fault. That's patriarchy's fault. And as you and I both know, patriarchy does not serve men, and it doesn't serve women. It doesn't serve anybody. And it does, you know, quote, serve men in an enormous amount of ways, but ultimately it doesn't, right? Ultimately they're suffering. Ultimately, they're dying by suicide at more alarming rates than anyone else. Like, there are so many ways in which patriarchy destroys men while purporting to support them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I, you know, I've talked a lot about how patriarchy exists to serve men. But I think what's going on a lot is that men are socialized to be ready for one type of world that doesn't really exist anymore, and a type of relationship that women don't want and never wanted and now have ability to leave. So I think men get in these relationships and they're shocked. They're shocked that a woman would dare have any expectations at all. They're shocked that a woman would be satisfied with him like rolling on top of her, pumping and dumping for 30 seconds and then going to sleep. They can't believe it, that, you know, these appliances actually have feelings. And I think that there's some early socialization stuff that's going on. And then I think women are socialized also to accept it for a long time. And that's the thing that I see a lot, is that the amount of abuse that women tolerate before they really start to understand that their marriages are bad is immense. That's right. You know, men want to pretend like, oh, she left me because I wasn't perfect. And it's like, no, like, she left you because you didn't shower for 2 weeks and you never gave her an orgasm in 20 years and because you were a terrible parent and like a fucking worthless monster. Yeah, but like, right. Why is it that women in these just objectively terrible marriages often need so long to see these marriages for what they are, and often will even defend their husbands as, oh, he's a nice guy. Like, what's going on there?
That's right. Oh, I hear that all the time. Yep. You know, he's a great guy, but he, you know, cheats on me. He's a really great guy, but he has rage and anger issues. And like, what is the bar for a great guy? Like, I don't know what this measure is. We haven't sort of landed on the measure of a great guy. you write a lot about the nice guy, right? These men are not nice at all. But even when they are, even if they are well-meaning, they're still formed by this system. They're formed by misogyny. And, you know, that's not very nice. So I think we're in a really big shift, and I think it's part of this great divorce, is that, look, when I was going through this, 15, 16 years ago, when I was, you know, starting probably 17 years ago, just asking the question over and over again, should I stay or should I go? Like, how do I decide? How do I make this decision? Maybe there's something better out there. Maybe like this isn't right, right? There was no, there were no podcasts. There was no Instagram. Facebook was in its nascency, right? We were just like, no, but there was no public discourse about this stuff. And so as we have been exposing it for what it is, there's just so much more information, but the information is coming like too late. So I think that what we're seeing now is that women have access to information, but the information is sort of coming on the heels of their experience, right? So we have, I think that there is going to be a tipping point where, like, I see this with my son, who's Gen Z, he's 19, that they have the information ahead of time and they're doing relationships differently than, you know, we did when we started out, right? And so I think that people are overwhelmingly opting out of these relationships right now, because they have so much information now. The next phase of this is for them to not opt into them. But of course, as with any systemic change, what's happening is that the resistance gets stronger first.
Yes, right? Yes, the backlash.
So the backlash right now is so intense. There is, you know, look, we had like, as I always call, I call him, you know, toxic abuser in chief, who is like, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about this on, but, you know, this is on a national level. This is on a political level. This is on a very enormous stage that this kind of behavior is tolerated, and not just tolerated, but lauded and elected. And so, you know, it just gets louder and louder and bigger and bigger, but it's going to have to die out because people are seeing it for what it is, finally, because we're talking about it, because you have a podcast, because I have a podcast, because we're on Instagram and social media, and we have this broader reach rather than just like some random book in a library that somebody might happen upon.
You know, I think that one thing that women are stumbling upon is sort of the power of being willing to be disliked. Now, in a patriarchy, being disliked is dangerous because men are violent. But, you know, being willing to like have men not really like you, have other women think you're nuts. I think there's a lot of power in that. You were getting divorced around the time that I was getting married. And when my husband and I got together about 15 years ago, people thought I was nuts, that I had a list of criteria that he had to meet.
That's right.
They thought it was absolutely insane that he and I were sitting down and memorializing our commitments and our relationship standards and our expectations of each other. You know, just why would you be? You're just crazy and your expectations are unreasonable. And, you know, 15 years later, like, I'm fucking obsessed.
Jokes on them.
Yeah, I am fucking obsessed with my husband and insanely in love. And everybody I know is either trapped in a miserable relationship or has left one. And so I often think about that and tell women about that, that like, you know, it's okay to have people think you're being unreasonable, and a person who you're supposed to be with will not see you having basic standards and needs as unreasonable. And that in itself can be its own like kind of litmus test. So I hope more people will move toward just having standards at the beginning of their relationship and really like holding men to some sort of reasonable standard. So I want to talk kind of about your bread and butter, because you're a divorce coach, which means you kind of fill in the gaps that like the lawyer, the therapist, the guardian ad litem, all of that don't do. You're really like, you're like the divorce shepherd. You just see women through.
Someone called me a midwife.
Yes.
Actually, it was a guy I was dating, which was, he was like, you were like my midwife for my divorce. And I was like, that's not really what I was being in with, you know, that's not exactly why I was in the relationship, but thanks. I should have invoiced him. But But yes, and because there is a gap, right? There's a huge gap between attorneys, first of all, God love them, they're trained in the law. They're not trained in, you know, human emotion and psychology. They're not trained in, you know, they're not as attorneys I've seen, I know, that'll say, you know, I'm literally the most expensive untrained therapist you can ever hire. So please don't come in here with your emotions, because it's, you know, it's going to cost you. You know, the other thing is that attorneys tend not to be, in this generally speaking, tend not to be that great at explaining the process. Their clients. And they're not that great at assessing strategy. They're great at, you know, filing motions or addressing this or addressing that, but like as a whole and a strategy, that is what I do. I help women get into the proper mindset for divorce. 9 times out of 10, especially when someone's been abused, they're like, it is not fair. He cheated on me and I'm not splitting, you know, custody with him, or he's been like this. And, you know, I like, they just want someone to finally hear them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they get to court and they explode all of this stuff that someone's finally listening. And then they look unhinged. Right.
Yeah.
And then it backfires on them. And so what I do is I work with my clients, especially on mindset. It's a really important thing to understand that, you know, there's a difference between what's legal and what's fair. And most people don't think about it that way. They actually don't know the difference between what's legal and what's fair. They don't know how to have a strategy mindset when going into any form of negotiation for divorce. Right? Like, we have to leave our emotions at the door, but we also need a place to put them, right? So a coach is a really great place to go vomit all of your, look, your therapist, you could go in and vomit all your stuff and they'll say, thank you very much. It's, you know, it's been 50 minutes and, you know, see you next week. For a, you know, an attorney, you're going to go in and vomit all your stuff and they're going to be like, okay, none of that matters. And that'll be $750. And then, you know, a coach can go, okay, let me hold it all, you know, let's vomit it all out. And then I go, okay, this actually matters. This matters. Okay. That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. In the eyes of the law, I get, you are valid. Your feelings are valid, but in the eyes of the law, these things do not matter. Here's what does matter. And here is how we're going to strategically organize this to present in court, in a way that will actually matter to a judge, possibly, depending on the judge, because the family law system is just not that just, especially when it comes to women. So that is what I do. I will hold all of your anger and your rage and your fear and your terror of your, you know, hurting your children, and we will strategize how to bring that to your attorney in a way that's going to save you a fuck ton of money, because your attorney doesn't have to sort of parse through all of your emotional baggage that they don't understand. And then we're going to present it to your attorney in a way that they can use, in a way that makes sense to them.
I love that, because I think the thing that women really need to understand is that the bar for seeing women as crazy is so low that any expression mm-hmm. of emotion means you're just a complete nutcase. And,
that's right.
And the bar for seeing right. men as abusive is impossibly high, such that he right. could beat you in front of the judge and the judge might, you know, wonder what you did to deserve it. And so we that's have right. to be really strategic.
Or he could beat you in front of the judge and the judge would say, well, he didn't beat the kids though. So
right.
he still gets 50-50 custody.
Or why didn't you protect the kids from this beating? Why didn't you
right.
leave earlier?
And, mm-hmm, that's right. And there are women in jail for more time than their abusers for failure to protect
their
children.
Oh my God, it's outrageous. So I was actually mm-hmm. thinking about you last night, because I was working with a reader on her affidavit for her custody and restraining order and all of that. And mm-hmm. she's had a really profoundly abusive marriage in every way that a marriage can be abusive. Her husband is just a complete monster. And she sent me like 30,000 words. And,
yeah.
you know, buried mm-hmm. in those 30,000 words is like one sentence about the abuse. And I was like, you know, this is what coaching is really for, is to get to that one sentence, to help you sharpen that sentence so that you can use it to just stab your abusive ex.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we know that the system is biased, and you know, I think that that is starting to make its way into the public consciousness, which is a good thing because now there's a movement to improve it. But one of the things I worry about is I see women saying, well, the system is biased, and so there's no hope. I can't leave. My husband is going to get 50-50 custody, and I'm going to get nothing. They really believe this. They believe they have no right to family property. They believe that there's nothing they can do. Can you speak to that? Because what I see when I interview married women is they're terrified to leave and they think it's all going to be awful. And when I interview divorced women, they are universally thrilled and they wish they had left earlier. So, you know, again, there's bias, but can we give the women who are thinking about leaving some hope?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, I do not know anybody who regrets their divorce. Like, I don't think I've ever met anyone who regrets it. If you get to the point where you're so miserable that this is on the table and this is what you're choosing to do and all the hoops that you have to jump through in order to do it, like you're on the other side and you are relieved. I run a group program that's got, you know, I don't know, upwards of 50, 60 women in it right now. 50, 60 women at a time in it. And every one of them is going through the process. And every one of them, some of them are on the other side. Not a single one of them regrets it. And they're still in it. Like they're still in the process. But once they get into a separate living space, it's like all of the clouds clear, right? They're not being triggered 24/7 and they can actually start to think. And they can actually start to use their executive function and their, reasoning. And they're like, holy shit, I can't believe I waited so long. This is insanity. I can breathe for the first time. So if you're in a place where you're really contemplating this and feeling the weight of, but what about my kids? And, you know, am I going to screw up my kids? First of all, it is the only thing that messes up children is toxicity. And that is in a home or an intact marriage or outside of it. So if by, you know, God's grace, you can have an amicable divorce, it's going to be a lot better than keeping them in a toxic environment. That being said, you don't have control over how your spouse is going to respond and react to this. And there could be a lot of toxicity, but two separate homes gives your children at least one place. And the research backs up that as long as they have one home in which they feel comfortable, confident, loved, nurtured, cared for, they will be okay. They're going to need therapy, all of the things. But who doesn't? But if you provide them this one safe place to land, even if it's only 50% of the time, you give them the gift of perspective. You allow your children to understand the difference between toxicity and calm, between, you know, blame and shame and all of the things, whatever it is that they feel at the other parent's house. When they come to your house, they get the difference, right? As opposed to being mired in it all the time and just sort of feeling like something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. You give them a place for their nervous systems to settle. They have an opportunity to like calm down and be at peace for a period of time. And as things go along, if you can document any of the issues that are happening at the other house and they rise to a level that a judge might make a decision, you know, this is why I also recommend not rushing the divorce, right? Separate for a time, because then you give someone either the rope to hang themselves or you give them the opportunity to step up and become a really great parent, even if they haven't been historically. But if you rush through the divorce and you get divorced, then you've got a decree, you're going to have to go back to court. You're going to have to file more motions, and it's going to be really more difficult to change something that's already legally in place. So give it some time. Allow the other parent the opportunity to either figure it out and step up, or you get enough rope to hang themselves, and so that you can get enough evidence and documentation so that when you do go to court, you're actually prepared.
I think that's great advice. And I like what you said about giving children a place to regulate their nervous systems. Mm-hmm. Because what I hear constantly from women is, well, I can't protect her at her dad's house. And we feel such pressure as mothers to make our children's childhoods perfect. And we often fear the unknown more than we fear the familiar awful. And I think women really need to consider that 50% safety, which is what you get if you get 50-50 custody, is better than no safety at all, which is what you get if your child is living constantly with an abuser. So sometimes,
yes. The thing that I hear, right, that everyone says is, at least I can protect them when I'm, you know, if I'm there all the time. But that's a fallacy. What you're doing is co-signing the behavior.
Yeah.
You look like you're protecting, you feel like you're protecting, but you're not. Protecting them would be getting them the fuck out, even if it's only half the time.
Yeah. Okay. So to that point, you know, there are some situations where I think women can protect. Like if a man is just unsafe completely with a child and will leave, you know, a 2-year-old unattended in the bathtub, that sort of thing, maybe you're stuck. But when you are working with women and coaching them on should I stay or should I go, what sorts of things should people consider? What are the most important things to think about?
Mm. Well, the very first thing that I have women really look at is getting in touch with their authentic self, capital S self, right? Because so often we've got the magnifying glass on their behavior. Does their behavior rise to the level of like, is it bad enough for me to leave? Like, I don't know, like other men are better, like, you know, other men are worse, or, you know, like but it's always about them. And so if we just shift it, like, how do I feel in this relationship? How does this relationship actually make me feel? Do I feel my best self, or do I feel like the absolute worst version of myself? What does my inner sense of knowing, my intuition, really, really, really know? And it's really hard for us to connect with our intuition when we are being abused, when we have our defenses up all the time, when we're being, you know, criticized or anything like that, right? It's really hard to connect with your sense of self when basically your whole life feels like it's out of alignment with that self. And when you have set up your whole life as a sort of protection mechanism to deny what you kind of know intuitively. But it is the most important thing to do, right? So the first thing I do with my clients is really connect them with, like, what do you know, right? No judgment, no criticism. You don't have to do anything about it, but what do you know? And it can be very, very quick, right? It's usually a very fast answer, right? Like, I know this is wrong. Okay, great. What are we going to do about that, right? Then we're going to do some education about, you know, I will send them your articles. I will send them, you know, certainly my book, right? Information to be like, actually, there's a name for what you're experiencing. And it is actually not okay. So we'll do the internal work and then we'll start looking at the relationship. I have a great healthy relationship checklist. I'll give it to you if you want. We can put it in the show notes. It's a healthy relationship checklist. And it's all about, like, how do I feel in this relationship? Do I feel emotionally safe? Do I feel physically safe? Right? Things like that, that are pretty objectively clear. And then you can score it, right? Like, I actually, it's a quiz that you can just score yourself.
Oh my God. I love to be able to score other people. That's just my favorite thing.
Yes. you know, and so, you know, and then obviously as we move down the line, we get deeper and more intense to the work, because then it's like you start to pull back the layers and you start to uncover things. And when you uncover them, then you have to do the hard work of really actually examining it, right? And that's the hard work, but that's also the work that, you know, a good therapist or coach who specializes in this area, and I want to really actually want to highlight that because it's really important to work with someone who has a specialty in what it is that you are dealing with. Not all therapists are created equally. There is zero training on recognizing the signs of domestic violence in basic therapy training. So, you know, so many people go to couples therapy thinking a therapist is going to like get understand what's going on, and you know, and they're not trained to, and they're not going to, unless they actually have training in this, and in which case they won't see you as a couple. If they recognize abuse, they will tell you that that is, you know, contraindicated, and send you resources. So you need to be working with someone who has a specialty in this area. Otherwise they can do a lot more damage.
I love how you focus on the woman, because I think that we have this idea that women have to earn the right to leave, and they have to earn the right to leave by proving that he is bad enough. But women are actually whole people on their own, and you can just leave if you're unhappy. You don't have to prove to someone else that you're allowed to do it because you're allowed to have your own life. So
yes, and by the way, right, like even in court, like even if there's no abuse, there's nothing wrong. If you don't want to be married anymore, you get to say it's okay. That's it.
Okay. So a reality check about marriage, because I know that one of the things you do is you coach women through whether they can stay and fix their marriage or leave and go build a new life. How many actually stay and successfully fix their marriage, Kate? Like how many broken marriages can really be fixed?
Yeah. Look, at the end of the day, people in really healthy marriages, in really healthy and happy marriages, you can attest to this, Zahn. How many times have you woken up in the middle of the night and thought, should I stay or should I go?
Right. Yeah.
Is it right? Like never, right? You're like, I mean, even if Jeff pisses you off, you pretty much wake up every morning and go, thank God I got this guy, right? You're obsessed with him. So if you're waking up in the middle of the night and you're like, God, I don't know. I'm agonizing over this. And you're coming to my website or you're searching for podcasts and you're listening to this podcast or reading Zahn, probably there's something pretty wrong, right? That's already the bar. So most of the women I work with end up leaving, not because I force them to, but because they're already coming. They're looking for permission. They're looking for, is this bad enough? They're looking for, do I get to say? And so most of my clients do end up leaving. I have had a few that have stayed. The ones that have stayed have been because their husbands have done a complete 180. Now, you and I both know that as soon as we say we're done, they immediately see the light. They, you know, read all the books. They, you know, get into therapy, whatever it takes. And that usually that lasts maybe 2 to 3 months if we're lucky, because they're usually doing all those things as a tactic, right? Not because they've actually changed. So I've had a few clients who have really felt confident that their husbands really did change and that it was real and that they were going to give it another chance. And I say like maybe 2 to 3 in the last 12 years. Haven't heard back from them. So I can't tell you whether this is, you know, the turnaround was real or not. I really don't know. I really don't know. But generally speaking, the odds are not good. Yeah.
You know, 3 and 12 years, but you haven't heard back from any of them is a very ringing endorsement for the fixability of broken marriages.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's really, really alarmingly bad. Okay, so Kate, you mentioned dating someone. So after all you've seen, you date. So
No,
you don't. You're done with that.
No, I don't. When did I say that? No.
I don't. I may have hallucinated it.
You know, I don't, here's the thing. I will say, like, maybe I told you this, I don't know, like a month or so ago, my next door neighbor, my dear friend, did set me up with someone, and it was a good 2 weeks of, you know, conversations. We never met in person. We Zoomed. He was in another city, another state. But after, you know, 2 weeks of phone calls in which I just was like listening and nodding and okay, and not being asked a lot, I was like, nope.
Yeah.
Nope. And I also live in Los Angeles, and I am 53. And this is, you know, men my age like to date women who are in their 30s, if that, but I think they prefer to date women in their 20s. But so, you know, there aren't a lot of men out there that I have met, certainly, who are interested in dating somebody my age, but also who, I mean, given what I do as well, it's a bit of a, it's really hard. They don't like what I do.
Yeah, but I think that's, I mean, that's a flag because...
Oh, 100%.
Because like, 100%. Because
all right,
good men hear, well, I help women get out of bad marriages, and they think, well, I want a good marriage. And so they don't feel defensive. It's like the men who get really mad when I talk about how most men are bad in bed. And they're like, well, most women don't have sex with their husbands enough. It's like, bro, why are you bragging about like not being able to make a woman want to have sex with you? Like, you should be on my side. You should be on the side of, oh, well, I'm not like them. Like, I can make a woman scream. It's kind of the same thing. Like,
right. That's right. Exactly. So, if a man is intimidated or, gets defensive about what I do, then like, okay, bye. Like, I'm sorry. I'm also, you know, I'm successful in my career. I run my own business. If you're not adding to my life, like, my life is great. I've got, you know, a great kid. I've got a lot of animals. I've got some plants, not as many as you, but I've got some plants. You're my guru. What's it called? It's growing back.
I don't know what it is that's growing back in your house, Kate.
I sends on pictures of my plants and tell her whether it's too late or not. And she tells me no. And she tells me how to fix them. And it's working. Listen, my life is really good. And if someone is going to come into it, there better be an enhancement to it.
Yeah.
And I've yet to find that.
Well, I think it's interesting because you're attributing a lot of this to like personal characteristics of like you're in your 50s and you're successful and you're making money and you're counseling women. But I actually don't think it's because of your personal characteristics that it's hard to find someone decent to date. It's that most men have never learned to be likable, to be competent in bed, to be emotionally intelligent, to be any of the things that might make a woman want to voluntarily spend time with them. Yes. And so, so the dating pool of quality men is really narrow. And if
that's right,
women are really going to get out of these bad relationships, then we have to accept that like most women are going to be single because most men suck ass. And, you know, and there are some like really spectacular men who are never offended when I say most men suck ass because like they know, like,
that's right.
You know,
that's
so it's right. Like, do you want
to introduce me to them? You can introduce me to those men. I appreciate you saying that. And I think that, you know, when I say like I'm 53 and all of my personal attributes, what I mean is like most men aren't looking for that in their partner, which means that they actually suck.
Yeah, exactly. You know exactly. What I mean? Like, and like, I just want to like, I want to add again to that because, you know, I have like male listeners and I have a lot of women who like make their partners listen to me at gunpoint. If you are feeling defensive in response to this, it's because you are identifying with the low value men. And like, why would you want to do that? Why would you not want to identify with the kind of men that women actually want to be with, who are, emotionally intelligent, good at sex, good at parenting if they have kids, you know, good at having a meaningful relationship? Like, this is what men should want to identify with. So it's so weird to me how many men just immediately out themselves with, well, you hate men because you're speaking badly about the men who like stink and suck. Like, why do you want to be that?
Well, here's the thing is that real change is going to take men holding each other to account.
Yeah.
Because until the quote, really good men stand up and say to their brethren, dude, learn how to have sex. You're bad at it. Or, you know, that's not how you treat women, or, you know, whatever else it is, until men are willing to hold other men to account, we're not really going to get as far as we need to get.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the core. And, you know, I believe that social change has historically only happened when oppressive behavior becomes socially unacceptable. Like, mm-hmm. racism in schools did not end when schools were integrated. It just became less socially acceptable. So racists had to find other forms of racism. And I think that it is very similar with heterosexual marriage, that there is a large swath of men who don't really like women, who just mm-hmm. see them as fuck dolls, and they are mm-hmm. only going to begin changing their behavior when that behavior renders a man unfuckable, when, like, the only way to get a relationship with a woman is to not be a piece of shit.
That's right. That's
and
right.
so we have to, that. We have to, you know, men aren't changing, but women can mm-hmm. control who they have relationships with. And so we really have to, like, set the bar high.
Yep.
All right. So if you could give women who are planning to leave their marriage just one piece of information that you think they need to have or a myth that you need to dispel, what would it be?
I think the myth that, well, what I want women to know is that they deserve to be happy.
Yeah.
And if there are things in their marriage that are really causing them distress, they don't have to suffer anymore. And that happiness is possible outside. This is radical, right? Radical. Happiness is absolutely possible for women outside of relationships with men. And it goes against everything we've been taught since very, 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 very young. It's not only possible, it's actually... you know, sometimes preferable. So
sometimes,
So we, you know, we deserve to be happy. You, if you're listening and you're questioning this, you deserve to be happy, and your children deserve a happy mother, a mother who is not stressed and, you know, beaten down and has no self-esteem anymore and can't figure out what the fuck happened to her. Right? That is not liberated motherhood in any sense. And your children deserve a mother who is liberated, and you deserve to be happy.
I think that's great. And so on the other end of this, you have seen how the myriad of red flags that men wave manifest over the course of a relationship. What is your advice at the beginning of a relationship? What do you wish women knew or could internalize?
I wish women would go very, very slowly into new relationships. First of all, I wish everyone would take, after getting out of a bad relationship, take a year to heal. Dr. Romani talks about this, and she has such great information and advice on this, especially in her newest book, because we need a year. You need a year to go through all the seasons to really heal yourself. And then anyone who you start to date after that period of healing will have to get through kind of layers of healed membrane. And you will become very protective of your healed self, such that you will notice things in ways that you have not before. If you dive right into the dating pool, you dive right into relationships, you get sucked back into that vortex. The marriage rate for first marriage, the divorce rate for first marriages hovers around 50%. For second marriages, it's about 68%. For third marriages, it's 74%. We're getting worse at it because we jump right in. We don't do the healing work. We are using the same picker. We've got to heal the picker before we start choosing again. So I really, really, really want women to take the time to heal themselves so that when they start dating again, they are really, really discerning. And that requires going slowly and intentionally into any new dating or relationships. And it sucks, and it's not romantic, it's not exciting, and it's not like full of fireworks and na-na-na-na-na-na. But that shit dies, and you'll be left exactly where you are now.
Yeah.
So, you know, the intentionality with which you went into your marriage is exactly what I want for everybody. I want that level of intentionality. And that's the only way you're going to actually heal and have a better relationship on the other side, if you choose to at all.
Yeah. So I would tell listeners, I met my husband about 2 years after I got out of a really bad relationship, not an abusive one. Hi, Jesse. You might be listening. But just, we were like really ill-suited to each other.
Sure.
And yeah. I was just destroyed by the end of this relationship. And I made a list of the non-negotiables that I wanted. And the way I assessed whether my partners met this list was not to ask them, because then they'll all say, oh, yeah, of course I'm a feminist. Of course I love women. Of course I care about good sex. Mm-hmm. I looked at behavior over a long period
That's right.
of time. And I think that making what you need objective and measurable, rather than saying, I want someone who's nice, identifying like uh-huh. what nice means, mm-hmm. and then looking at behavior to assess that, is really the only way that it's going to work in a profoundly broken society. And even then, a lot of men are going to sneak through. So like you said, you just have to move slowly. So the final thing I have for you is, we have an advice question from a reader. So I always okay. do this when I have a guest, and Kate and I are going to kind of brainstorm an answer to this together and see what we can come up with. So here's this reader's question. Is there anything women can do to counter the misogyny in the family court system? And can we ever use misogyny to our advantage?
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So the first part is, the first part of the question is absolutely. And part of that is what we were talking about earlier, about having a strategy mindset and understanding that when women show emotion, particularly in court, we are deemed crazy and unstable. And it sucks, but it's the fact of the system. And so we have got to have some level of acceptance of the fact that that is the system we're in. Right? Because if you're not changing the system when you're actually trying to get something from it, right? Your activism is welcome when you're on the other side. But the first thing you have to do is understand and accept what system you're in, and then have a completely clear-headed strategy, understanding what's legal versus what's fair, having this strategy mindset, and a lot of patience, because this is not a fair system and it takes a very long time. And if you want things to unfold in your favor, not rushing it is going to be a huge part of it. So those, I have this, my 7-step divorce mindset reset, which is, you know, sort of outlines all of this stuff, which is really important. So that's sort of how you work within it. Using it to your advantage, I don't know. Zahn, what do you think?
Well, so
I'm gonna toss that to you.
I liked what you said about recognizing the system that you're in, because, uh-huh. you know, people often say, like, aren't you making women feel bad when they see misogyny everywhere and when they see most men as sexist and most relationships as sexist? And I actually think the answer is no, because then you can stop blaming yourself. You can stop saying, oh. well, I'm not a good enough person, partner, wife. I've caused this to happen.
Right.
And I think the same is true in the court system. And something that I hear quite frequently from women that is very alarming is, well, I'm going to teach the system a lesson. I'm going to show how much it's hurt me by disobeying this court order. And you're not going to teach the system a lesson. The system is the system. And so you just have to know what you're working with. And I do think that there are some ways that you can use misogyny to your advantage, while still remembering that misogyny is a system designed to disadvantage women and there is no opt-out button. But if you understand what misogyny wants from you, if you understand what patriarchy says a good mother looks and acts and talks like, then you can use that to inform your strategy. You know, you have to seem gentle and kind and not combative and not weird, unfortunately. And the more you can conform to the image of what a good mother should be and do, especially if you're a working mother, especially if, you know, your partner is throwing your feminism in your face, I think the more you will have an advantage. And it's really easy to do because we're all socialized to do that shit anyway. We all know what misogyny wants from us, even if we have rejected it. So, you know, like you said, like not trying to fight the system while you're in it and stepping back and thinking, how do I need to be perceived? And what do I need to do to be perceived that way?
I think that's brilliant. As always, Zahn, you're brilliant. I think it's absolutely true, right? Like down to like, how do I dress for court?
Yes.
Right? Because we, like it should be, I dress however the fuck I want. No, misogyny dictates that there's a certain way that you have to dress for court. And it's going to be understated and it's going to be simple and it's not going to cause, you know, call any attention to any of your body parts, right? You're, and so that is how we, use misogyny to our advantage, as it were.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
I would also tell people, you have to do what the court tells you to do. The fastest path to losing custody of your children, and really the only way that normal non-abusive mothers typically lose custody of their children is by disobeying court orders. You just can't do it. You can't not show up for court. You can't disobey the court order. You can't fight with the judge. You can't do any of that. It's not fair, but, you know, you can have a fairer outcome if you just do what you're told as much as it sucks. And I would also ask yourself, like, in the eyes of society, not in my eyes or Kate's eyes or the eyes of feminism, what are the most important points here? So a typical judge is not going to care that there's household labor inequality, you know, that you gave up your career for whatever. They're going to care about physical violence. They're going to care about extreme abuse of the kids. You know, they are going to care if you're the primary caregiver about like what that meant. You know, you can talk about maintaining the status quo and all of that. But you really need to focus on the stuff that society cares about and leave all the other stuff out because it's a distraction. You know, a judge is going to skim your case. And if see he hit me, he punched me, he kicked me, he screamed at the kids, he broke the child's arm, whatever, that's much more useful than 11 pages and one sentence about, oh, and by the way, he has guns.
Right. And also, by the way, the most distressing part about this is that even then, sometimes the court doesn't care.
Yeah.
We've got a case right now in Colorado, Rachel Pickrell Hawkins. She refused reunification therapy for her children with her husband or her ex-husband.
Kate, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. Can you just explain like super briefly what reunification therapy is? Because I think a lot of people don't know.
Jesus. Yes. Okay. Reunification therapy is... quote, therapy that very often is used as a way to, quote, reunify children with their abusers. And there is a whole, it's a rabbit hole to go down, but very, very often it is used in conjunction with claims of parental alienation, which is a, parental alienation syndrome was coined by this guy, quote, Dr. Richard Gardner, who was an absolute quack and he's been debunked. He essentially accused children of, I always never get it right because it always is so complicated and convoluted, but essentially he was a child sexual assault apologist.
Oh my God.
In many ways, and blaming the children for, quote, seducing their rapists. So everything that Richard Gardner has done should be absolutely debunked, but unfortunately it has become a cornerstone of the family court system. So as soon as somebody says, oh, but my wife is alienating my children, then we get into it immediately, right? What parents are usually doing is trying to protect their children from abusers. But as soon as they're accused of alienation, then it sort of kickstarts this whole system in the family court system, which is really dangerous and can very often include reunification therapy. And this is where children are forced into often camps where they're like go away for days at a time and or months at a time and are forced into intensive therapy with parents who have abused them, often sexually abused them, often physically abused them. So in Colorado, there is a woman, Rachel Pickrell Hawkins, whose ex-husband is accused of, and I think there is evidence to support that he raped his child or children or sexually abused them. She refused to let them go into therapy with him. And so now she is doing jail time and she has to go every weekend into jail. These are ways in which family court system can be so unfair and biased against women. Now, I don't want to scare anyone, and you know, I don't want people to freak out because these incidents are rare, but they're real. Even if you have evidence of abuse, even if it has been proven, very often you will see a judge say, well, he did it once and he hasn't done it in a long time. So, you know, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Or, well, he abused you and raped you, but he never actually did it with the children. Or he did it to one child, but not the other. So it's okay, right? These are ways in which the family court system is really dangerous. And again, I don't want to freak people out because it's not always this dangerous, but we have to find really strategic ways to work with it and work within it so that we can try to avoid something like this at all costs. And I do think that she will be vindicated. Rachel Pickrell Hawkins will be vindicated. I happen to know that the governor of Colorado is like interested in looking at these, you know, the laws that allow these kinds of things. And there is systemic change happening. But, you know, for example, in the Violence Against Women Act, there are provisions now that are against these reunification camps, but they have to be legislated in every state individually. And even when they are, they're hard to enforce. I don't know if that answered any questions.
No, I think that's helpful. And I will put in the show notes, there are a couple of investigative journalists who have been working specifically on this issue, one of whom I'm hoping to have on the show in a couple of months. So I will put some information in the show notes for people who want to learn more about this, because it really is quite a rabbit hole. And the level of abuse that children are exposed to in these reunification camps is just shocking.
Shocking. Yeah. And also a lot of these investigative journalists, unfortunately, get into it and then they have to get out because it's so toxic and exhausting.
Yes.
You know, there are other people, there's a group of us that are, you know, kind of working behind the scenes to try and get legislation and all sorts of stuff changed and, you know, doing amazing work, but it is exhausting and it is disheartening and it is emotionally taxing.
Yeah. It's just, all right. Well, on that note.
Anyway, on that note.
Well, Kate, I've loved having you. Thank you so much for coming on. Kate is doing just incredible work. So I really urge everyone to check Kate out. Follow her on social media. Buy her new book, The D Word. It might be the lifeline you've been waiting for. Kate can really help you through these just horrible storms. And if you like this podcast, I hope you'll share it with other people. Subscribe, leave a review, comment, all of the above. This really does make a difference. You can get bonus episodes by subscribing at zahn.substack.com. And you can see a whole bunch of other stuff at liberatingmotherhood.org. So thank you so much. And I will talk to you guys in 2 weeks.